Hello, friends. Welcome back to another episode of Theology in the Raw. I have on the show today my friend Grant Skeldon. Grant is a leader among the next generation. He started the Initiative Network when he was 23 years old with the goal of developing young leaders into Christ-loving, city-changing, church-investing, disciple-making local missionaries. Grant, that's a mouthful, but that really does capture your heart. And I have, just in the short time I've known Grant, I've learned a lot, so much about Gen Z. Gen Z, those who have been, were born after the year 2000-ish. And Grant is 30 years old, so he's a millennial. So we talk a lot about the difference between millennials and Gen Z. And I learned a lot in this episode, and every time I hang out with Grant, I just learn a ton about how to not just reach, but as he says, disciple the next generation of Christian leaders. Grant is the author of The Passion Generation. What's the subtitle on this? The Seemingly Reckless, Definitely Disruptive, But Far From Hopeless Millennials by Grant Skeldon, published by Zondervan. And so Grant currently is the next gen leader of Q Ideas. A lot of you know about Q Ideas. In fact, when this podcast comes out, I will either be at or getting ready to leave for the Q conference out in Nashville. No, it is not QAnon, okay, people. It is Q Ideas, the conference, the cultural culture summit, I think it's called, in Nashville, April 22nd and 23rd. So anyway, if you would like to support the show, you can go to patreon.com/theologyintheraw and support the show for as little as $5 a month and get access to premium content, including once a month podcasts that I record answering all of the questions sent in from my Patreon supporters, once a month blogs that I write for my Patreon supporters. So join the Patreon community, join the Theology in the Raw community at patreon.com/theologyintheraw. Okay, without further ado, let's get to know the one and only Grant Skeldon. Hello, welcome back to another episode of Theology in the Raw. I'm here with my friend Grant Skeldon. Grant, thanks so much for being on the show for the first time.
Yeah, man, thank you for having us. We're wearing the same thing, bro.
You got the memo. Oh, good.
Yeah.
For those who are listening only, we are, this is also a video. We do this video and audio, so there is a YouTube version of this conversation. But Grant, why don't you give us a little introduction to who you are for people that don't know your name, and then I really want to dive into this, I mean, just the really pertinent topic of understanding and ministering to and coming alongside and learning from Gen Z, which I know that's the world you've been living in for a while. But who are you, Grant?
Yeah. My name is Grant Skeldon. I am, the Skeldon name is a South African name, actually. So my dad's South African. My mom is the youngest of 14 in this massive Mexican family. And so I'm half South African, half Mexican, dude. Nice. From Dallas. I've been in Dallas, honestly, my whole life until 4 months ago, in the midst of COVID, some things started shaking up, and I started feeling some clarity from God on stuff to where I kind of got to know you through this transition. Even is about 4 or 5 months ago, I got married. I moved to Nashville, and I moved to Nashville because I just recently joined Q Ideas with Gabe and Rebecca Lyons. I have a history of speaking on behalf of younger generations, especially more so the millennial generation, but mostly to older generations to help them either, whether it's pastors that are just trying to reach the next generation, parents that are trying to raise the next generation, or sometimes a lot of times business leaders that are trying to better retain the next generation, since so many millennials were job hopping. And then I wrote a book with Zondervan called The Passion Generation. The Keynotes version is, it's kind of a Trojan horse book that acts like it's a book to help you better reach the next generation, but it's really just a book about how you should disciple the next generation. Okay. And how to practically do that. It's a very practical book on discipling the next generation, where instead of meeting with them one-on-one once a month or once a week, it's more about including them in your life. Mm-hmm. It's a lot less about mentoring them and saying, hey, come and meet with me, but it's more about discipleship. Mm-hmm. Where you say, hey, come and follow me and join my world. So that was a book I wrote 2 years ago. And then, a big thing I'm probably known for among young leaders, but it's more private on the larger scale, is I've stumbled into and found that I have like a gifting and even I would say a calling to try to the best of my ability to unite and accelerate some of the most diverse and dynamic young Christian leaders across the country to reach probably the most lost generation we've ever seen. And so I do a lot of retreats and sometimes international trips where I take very high caliber young Christian leaders who are, let's say, professional athletes, speakers, authors, online influencers, musicians, worship leaders, pastors, itinerant speakers. Just get, if you're a young Christian in your 20s or maybe early 30s and have a national platform, very intentional to kind of recruit this group into a growing family of young Christian leaders, because I just think it's going to be crucial that the next generation Christian leaders are united.
Yeah, absolutely. What were you doing in Dallas before joining Q Ideas?
I mean, those retreats and speaking a lot were what I've been doing about 7 years now.
Were you working? Was it part of a bigger organization, or you do it just more as independently?
Yeah, the group was called Initiative Network.
Okay, cool. Mm-hmm. I'm curious. I wasn't planning on asking this, but I need to know because people keep asking me this. Has Q had to rebrand itself? I mean, a year ago, nobody knew what QAnon was, but now it's like everywhere. And I can't even wear I hate it. You guys gave me a sweet looking hat with a Q on it, and I can't wear it anywhere because everybody's going to think I'm QAnon.
I know. It sinks Preston, think about, okay, so I got married in November and then joined the staff officially after getting married, but I only got to finally move to Nashville around January. The first week of January. So I moved to Nashville as my first week working for Q Ideas. And honestly, some older people, when I was telling them that I was moving to Nashville to work for Q, some of them were saying stuff, oh, so your true colors are finally coming out, huh? And I'm like, what does that mean? It's in text form. And so I'm like, yeah, I guess so. And I'm like, they start saying stuff about conservative and ultra conservative. Yeah. And I'm like, I don't get it. Like, I don't feel like Q's known that, like, as a strong ultra conservative. I don't get it. But I kept getting those jokes. And once I started looking into it more, I was like, why do people keep saying this? And they told me, because I don't think young people really at that point yet knew too much about QAnon. It was mostly from the older people that got it. However, my first week was January, and then whenever the Capitol event happened, that's when I feel like really even young people knew, especially what Q was. Because that dude with like the horns and that weird outfit and like barbarian kind of look, he actually held a sign that said, Q sent me. That was the sign that he held. If you Google him, look up Q sent me and that guy. And I was just like, oh my goodness, it's terrible. So it stinks because the organization has been around for 18 years. But yeah, we definitely usually say Q Ideas now more than we used to just say Q, because that's the website. A lot of times that's some of the branding. But yeah. I do think we are heavily considering what does rebranding look like, really? So we don't have to just say who or not. We get to just continue to be like who we are. But I think we're thinking about potentially announcing that here at the conference, but we want to put a little more time and not just be very knee-jerk reaction responsive to all of it.
It is. I mean, it's part of me is like, oh, that kind of sucks. I get it. Another part's like, oh, come on, like whatever. So somebody else used the letter of the alphabet and it's an entirely different organization, like whatever. But then you do have to put up with, or do you guys get emails or this or that of people assuming you're part of QAnon, or is it really not that big of a deal?
Yeah, I mean, some people. And I think bigger than that is I think we did a survey and found that a little bit less than half of the people that would think about sharing our content they said would this get misconstrued as QAnon instead of Q Ideas, because the videos and the content we have online all has a little Q at the bottom. And so that's probably more problematic that they have to even consider, should I share this or will they get, people perceive this.
I think people are way overly self-censoring these days. I get it. I mean, it's one of the reasons why I don't walk around in public with the hat on, just because I don't want, it's just more like, I just don't have time for anybody to say something or whatever. Or I mean, I live in Idaho, so I don't want people to kind of give me like a high five, you know?
Yeah.
But I don't know. Like, I would have zero problem sharing something, even if loads of people were like, I can't believe you're 4Q. I'm like, dude, use your brain for half a second and just realize that maybe I'm the letter is used to identify another organization. Like, come on. Anyway, yeah. That's not why you're here, Grant. You're here because I... we were at a private gathering in January, shortly after you moved to Nashville, and we had a panel of young Gen Z leaders, and I was blown away. I was really blown away at their heart, their focus, the questions they're asking, their passions, and one of the things that, and this is not a word for word thing, but one of them said, one of the people on the panel, I think 19, 20-year-old. Said something like, you know, yeah, you millennials out there, you know, you try to make Jesus really cool and sexy and attractive. We don't care about that. We want a meaningful Jesus. We want the authentic Jesus. We want a Jesus who's not afraid to tell us, hey, you should do this and shouldn't do that. We want a Jesus who cares about holiness. You know, I was like blown away, you know, but then I thought anecdotally, I'm like, yeah, I'm raising 4 Gen Z kids and they're just, you try to make Jesus cool, they sniff that out and they actually can't stand it, you know? So I'm like, that kind of resonates with even my little world here, but, can you give us maybe even start there, but help us understand. I mean, you've done such extensive work with a broad range of Gen Z leaders and Gen Z people. And, how help us understand this generation as older Christian leaders, how can we, have a more accurate perspective on what Gen Z is thinking through right now?
Yeah, I mean, kind of commenting on that, I remember, basically, I think that when I look at the Xers, because just, I mean, a lot often whenever we talk about generations, people are going to kind of, want to know what ages are we talking about. So millennials would be kind of generally around 1980, born between 1980 to 2000. And then Gen Z would be born after that. So Gen Z is usually about 23 to 25 or younger. And then Xers would be kind of like millennials, of course, parents' age. And when I think when millennials saw church, they saw that Xers had kind of shifted and built a church. Let's go to just even boomers' church. I mean, boomers got to live in maybe the last Christian generation where it's like everyone kind of just assumed Christianity, kind of generally went to church. And it wasn't as, I guess, postmodern, if you will. And I just feel like, I grew up in Dallas and I remember asking, an old lady in Dallas once, I was like, you know, surely not everybody was a Christian. I'm sure everybody was churched here in Dallas because Dallas is such a church culture. Mm-hmm. But I was like, what about, there must've been people that just didn't really buy in and didn't really have a true faith. That didn't go to church. And I was like, what did those people do? Like, would they hang out on Sundays and just what did they do on Sundays instead? And she said, you know, I had friends definitely that didn't go to church when I was younger. However, they would never hang out outside of their house on a Sunday because you never would want to be seen not in church on Sunday. And I was like, man, that's like the culture of church had really bled into the community, at least of Dallas, again, a very church city. Yeah. And so all I have to say is I feel like church was this sacred event, but could sometimes become like somewhat of a stodgy, judgmental place as well. And that burned a lot of people and that hurt some people that we started seeing de-churched and some unchurched people when I think like the Bill Hybels and the Rick Warrens and the Andy Stanleys and the Xer generation kind of created, or these would be like older Xer guys built church. They kind of, I think every generation personally responds the pendulum to the other side. And there's some really great things that come out of that, but there's also some dark sides or shadows to that, if you will. And so to my opinion, they went away from like the sacred event and they kind of say, how do we make this an awesome event? Or at least the very minimum, I feel like they try to make church more comfortable. Like, how do we make Jesus or church more comfortable for those who have been hurt by church, don't see church and think of it as something they could connect with or relate with, but they actually come and like they feel welcome. They love the experience. They have something for their kids. I really feel like family church especially kind of came out of that movement of making church comfortable. I feel like my generation of millennials saw that and were like, man, church is so comfortable that it's kind of just fluffy and it's not like, mm-hmm. it's not that raw, if you will. And I feel like and authentic that they swing the pendulum over to the other side where they're like, we don't really want church to be comfortable. We really want a cause. And I think we try to make it a cause. However, the downside or the shadow, I think, of millennial generation is as cause oriented as we wanted the church to be, and we've tried to make church and all that to be, is the downside is we've also tried to make church cool. We've tried, like, how can we make church cool? How can we make us cool? And how can we make somehow Jesus cool? And so I think that was the rise of the Judah Smiths, the Rich Wilkersons, the Carl Lentz, you look at what a youth pastor today looks like compared to a youth pastor like in the 90s. The 90s youth pastor was like the puka shells and like a tight t-shirt from camp and just some cargo pants or shorts. And now a youth pastor looks like straight out of New York, like fashion. I mean, there's a reason why Preachers and Sneakers has so much content to build off of. It's like millennials have the shadow of trying to, which the irony is, I think Jesus, I mean, the gospel does permeate into what we would call causes. It's just the shadow is like you can't make Jesus cool. Like he can only be so cool until people don't like what he's saying and they have to change or they have to transform. And all that to say is, yes, it was comfortable. We responded and made it cool. And I think what I love about Gen Z right now is, yeah, I think that they don't want to make Jesus cool. They really want to get back to the heart of the gospel, the power of the gospel. I don't want to make this everyone, but I am meeting more and more Gen Z, more Gen Z leaders that I've met than millennial leaders that I have met that have this like revivalist type posture. And they remind me of like a Leonard Ravenhill or a Billy Graham, where they're like, yeah, just kind of how you said, we need to run from sin. We need to be like one of the young guys. I was just with one of the guys I respect so much that's Gen Z. And he was just saying, so often for the next generation, we're like, how can we give up just a little bit so we can have Jesus, but just give up a little bit? And he's like, I'm reading Abraham, and Abraham was willing to give up everything to have Jesus. And we got to stop asking the question of how much can I give up and still have him, instead of being, how much can I give up to have more of him? And I'm just like, dude, you're so old soul. But I think this is so refreshing. I just think focusing on Christ instead of focusing on cool is their big thing. Is it's while the world is heating up and they're being bold with what they believe, we need to stop trying to give a soft gospel or a palpable gospel. And just we need to be just as bold, if not bolder, and what we believe. And so I'm pretty pumped about Gen Z. And I think for millennials, our role will be very crucial to be disciple makers of the next generation and door openers for them.
It's funny. I mean, from my vantage point, when Christians try to do cool, it's kind of like Christian cool, which is always not really as cool as non-Christian cool. So it ends up being kind of like, no, if I want coolness, I'm not going to go to church. Like so I wonder, I guess that's kind of leading up to my question. Like where did that come from? Where did the kind of shift come from? Is it by just being unimpressed with Christian cool, or did it not even really come from even looking at, and maybe there's no easy answer to this, but I mean, like, what's cultivating that hunger for depth and meaningfulness? Is it maybe the bankruptcy of social media? I mean, I'm just kind of throwing that out there. Like, there's that kind of hunger for community, but it's like, this doesn't quite satisfy. I'm in the search for something more meaningful. And I'm just, my world around me is not giving that to me. I don't know.
I think probably the most hidden, subtle killer, I think, to the next generation. And this is young people in the church or out of the church. I actually don't think people in the church that are young, that are Christians, struggle less with this than young people out of the church. For whatever reason, it's just something we don't address too much. And I think Gen Z sees it and is hopefully going to address it better. Is I think comparison is the one of the most subtle killers of the next generation of Christian leaders and Christian Christ followers among young people, in the sense that, yeah, when you talk about bankruptcy, is the irony is when you're young and you're running away from the Lord, you care so much in that season of life before Christ about what other people think. And something happens where then you meet Jesus and you could care less what the world thinks for a season, for the beginning. And you just, all you care about is God's approval and hearing well done and just serving people. You have this like boldness that comes in that season. It's the kind of boldness that, again, Gen Z reminds me of right now. But something happens, I feel like, whether it's months in or years in, where all of a sudden you go back to your old ways where you may not care what the world thinks anymore, but I feel like a lot of millennial leaders, at least, maybe cared still about what Christians thought of them. We are kind of living in our own little castle of, yeah, we're cool within this small bubble, or we have approval or points. And I remember going to, I remember being in Israel once, actually, and it was, I don't know why, I always run into cool people in Israel or like in the church cool. And it's like, I was at the Wailing Wall once and Carl Lentz and Brian Houston were there. And it was like at the wall. Like, it's not like this is one of, there's a whole bunch of these. There's one place in the world and we happen to be there at the same time. And there's hundreds of people around us and no one knew who they were. Just the Christians did. Our crew was like, oh my God, look at who it is. I also, this is a different trip, and I remember being at a restaurant. Andy Stanley comes into the small restaurant, what? But no one's looking and being like, it's Andy Stanley, except for us, the Christians that were there, like blown away. and I think, I think that it's eye-opening even to me, be like, you know, in our little kingdom or castle, this is a big deal, but to everybody else in the world, it's really not. And so I don't know. What I'm really attracted about is like cool can get you so far. There's what I'd associate probably with next gen leaders that I know that have this like purity of heart is this boldness that you have. And I think they get to keep as long as they're like, hey, I'm going into a world that I will say, Preston, I do think that there maybe was a facade that you could make Jesus cooler maybe 8-10 years ago. Mm-hmm. And now I think there are certain, I think with the reality of being a Christian can often get you canceled, and how holding biblical values can often get you canceled. That facade is just gone. It's kind of like, okay, either you stand here with him or you don't. But I tell a quick story of these two guys that I was hanging out with this weekend, but they're here in Nashville. Is they did this big rave where they didn't do a rave. They partnered with some kids here in Nashville that were doing raves for high school students. And they were having these kids who were not believers, were having hundreds of kids come to these raves, get drunk, get high, go to a rave and just go crazy and dance. And they basically, these two kids are like, one of them here, his name's Luke Lefevre, is like, felt like God had called them to go and preach at this rave. And it's a crazy story where they got a venue called the Rocket Town that's owned by Michael W. Smith here, met with them, said, hey, if we could get you this venue for free to do your rave, would you let us preach the gospel for 30 minutes at the end of your rave? And I'm just like, dude, the boldness that these guys have. And the kids said, yeah. They said, we'll get it for free. And they said, all we ask also is that you put the money you would have put into venue to get as marketing, to get as many people as possible. And they had a little over 1,000 kids come to this thing. And I just thought to myself, I was even asking, I was like, how do you go into a rave bold to preach the gospel? I mean, like, they don't want to hear you. The last thing they wanted you to do is to stop the music and say, hey guys, like, just want to tell you real quick about Jesus. And the kid told me, he was talking about how, you know, none of the prophets were welcome, but they did have a boldness that came from God and a word that came from God. And he also, one of the things he talked about was how Goliath mocked David until the second that his head came off. He was mocking him. And he said, so I might be at mocked, but I know I had to pray. Because he said he was nervous. He said he was crazy nervous. But yeah, God just kind of reminded him, none of my messengers have been welcome. But there's a moment, there's like a shift in the room where you could just, the king, whether it's King Nebuchadnezzar, whoever it is, just notices the Pharaoh, whatever, hey, God is with this person right now. And I hundreds of kids responded to the gospel at that event.
Really?
And I'm just thinking, man, so crazy is actually one of the two kids, unfortunately, months later, which actually happened about a month ago now, because this story's from about a year ago. But the kid that did the raves, who was really moved by these two kids, it was actually his influence in some way, that he was so influential among all these young guys that when they were mocking the preacher, the young guy, he said, listen to him, because he was wanting to listen to him. And the rest of the crowd kind of like, listen to this guy. I kind of would consider that guy like the person of peace, if you will, that God gave him. And unfortunately, that kid was really moved by the gospel in that and built the relationship with them more. But he actually passed away in Texas in a car accident about a month ago. And they had a funeral, and they had about 1,500 people that showed up to this kid's funeral, 18 years old. And their parents said, hey, we know that he would want you two to preach the gospel at his funeral. And so with 1,500, again, hundreds of kids responded to the gospel.
Wow.
And I'm just like, again, blown away by the boldness of these guys. The last thing I'll say is, like, my hope for Gen Z is, you know, I heard David Platt once say one of the biggest problems for young Christian, I mean, sorry, for just Christian leaders is we all want to raise God's name. And we're trying to elevate his name, but we subtly kind of hope our name raises with his name as we're raising it. And my hope is that just for all generations of Christian leaders, but especially for Gen Z, that they can maintain this idea of let's just raise his name and it doesn't matter if our name is raised. In fact, the more biblical posture would be let's decrease our name in order to raise his name. So we don't care whose name raises with his name. It's just straight, hey, we just want his name to be known. And we have no other option. I mean, for Gen Z, it's the most lost generation they've ever seen. The biggest difference, too, I would say with millennials and Gen Z is millennials grew up seeing most of my friends leave church. All the guys I mostly went to high school with that were key leaders in youth ministry are not Christians or in church anymore. But Gen Z didn't grow up seeing them leave. They just grew up not ever having many Christian friends is what I'm finding. And so they have no option but to be a missionary.
Well, when you say they're the most lost generation, what does that mean? Like they are growing up outside of the church or in the church without a faith commitment? Or how are they more lost than millennials or Gen Xers?
I think that is that at least a lot of millennials grew up in church and then left.
Oh.
I think from what I'm seeing is a lot of them didn't even grow up in church. Or I would assume even growing up in church and then just knowing, hey, this isn't my thing. This is my parents' thing. Just a more openness of this isn't mine. But I'm just meeting more and more Gen Z leaders. I was like, what it was like in high school when you were a Christian? And I'm seeing more and more than I did with millennial leaders is they didn't grow up with many Christian friends. So I think that pressure and that reality check kind of pushes them to be missionaries sooner.
Okay. It's interesting you said that let me make sure I understood you correctly, that Gen Z, and again, this should go without saying, but we're speaking in generalities. Obviously, there's going to be exceptions.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Maybe even geographical differences too. But
And that is, because some of these guys I'm talking about are more up north. Like if we're going to talk about Dallas, Atlanta, Nashville, maybe some Texas cities, that might be a little different. But a lot of the guys I know, especially up north, they're like growing up with less Christian community, their own age.
So my question is, with Gen Z, is my assumption, and maybe it's the wrong assumption, is that with the pervasiveness of social media, that they are more prone to compare or want status, platform, name, more views on their YouTube or TikTok, whatever. Is that a wrong assumption? I'm not going on any data. I'm just kind of connecting dots in my head. But is that not really a correct assumption that they don't necessarily want status as much as millennials or Gen Xers did?
Yeah, I mean, I think definitely there's the more access you have to online, the more access you have to, or more ammunition, I guess, the enemy has for comparison and for any of that kind of stuff. I would say, and this is again where I'm similar to you, I don't have like all these stats on Gen Z when it comes to social media, is I do think I'm focused on high caliber young Christian leaders. So I couldn't even fully focus on like the general Christian and Gen Z. But I'll say the difference I'm seeing is there are more young people in Gen Z than I saw in millennials, that I think maybe because the oversaturation of social media, also they get to see a generation that's maybe 5, 10, 15 years ahead of them and seeing the effects of social media, because it still is a somewhat new experiment. I mean, millennials I think most millennials would have got social media around late in middle school. And now we're seeing the effect of like, and that would have been MySpace, at least for me. And then it was Facebook. And then so we've even seen like a handful of social media platforms be the biggest thing and then die, like MySpace. Facebook's not dead, but I think it's pretty dead to millennials and especially to Gen Z. And then continue to adopt new platforms. So seeing the negative impact, or maybe even like the fruitless impact of, man, that used to be so important. Now it's not even something I check or care about anymore. So there are, I think they're getting to see a little bit of the impact of that. However, I think the biggest thing among the young leaders that I'm working with that is the game changer that makes them care less about what other people in the world think, or even other young Christians think, is just discipleship. I mean, I personally think the biggest tip or trick you could ever, I could ever give someone on reaching the next generation truly is discipleship. I go so far to say that I don't even think there's a next gen problem, really. I think that there's a discipleship problem in our world today. And it may look like, no, we have the generations keep getting worse and worse. I think that young people, young singles personally, are always and always will be and have always been associated with like doing dumb stuff. I just think for boomers when they were young and single, they were immature. For Xers when they were young and single, they were immature. Like, I don't think, I think the only two things that have really changed is the lack of discipleship keeps getting worse and worse. And I do think the culture is changing too. And so when you don't have a generation getting discipled, and you keep getting less and less of each generation getting discipled, because we're just dropping the ball on that. Every generation gets worse. Plus culture is shifting more and more away from the things of God, away from the church. Mm-hmm. Then when we choose not to disciple the next generation, I believe the world gladly volunteers to do that instead of us.
I was going to say there, I often say people are being discipled by somebody, whether it's by the church or a Christian leader. That's another question. But like, I mean, this is, I always bring this up in sexuality conversations with churches, you know, that remain silent. I'm like, well, your congregation's being discipled daily, but in sexuality, gender conversations, what role your voice has, that's another question, but don't pretend like discipleship isn't happening. Might not be in the direction you want it to go, but
yeah.
I want to come back to actually the sexuality piece with the younger generation. I know that's a huge question, but, so with the social media thing, like, I'm my hope is that Gen Z will be the generation that sees the bankruptcy I use social media. I'm on social media and stuff, but just the enslavement to social media.
Yeah.
And seeing that as kind of your primary form of friendship and community and identity and all these things. I'm hoping that Gen Z will kind of say, it's isn't working. I'm going to start swinging back to rejecting kind of a life that's saturated with technology, or maybe more specifically social media. Do you see that happening? Not yet, or
it's like, I do want to say just yes or no. Like, I see the high forms both ways, in the sense of, I'd start with the bad and go to the good of, like, I see more an acceleration of young people that are, every generation, millennials had a high amount of this, and I think Gen Z has even higher of, like, believing they truly are going to and will be famous. That is a struggle for the next generation of thinking. Like, I wish I got to get the stats for this, but I know it's gone up by like a ton with millennials, and I know it's gone up a little bit more even with Gen Z. That the idea, it was, they did a study where they were like, it used to be, I think it was generally around 2 out of 10 of like extras or boomers thought they'd be famous. Well, now it's like 4 or 5 out of millennials think they will be famous. So almost half of them. And then I think it was at 6, around there generally. I just know it's incrementally got more. And I will say that isn't crazy to think. It is, it's a little improbable, but in millennial generation and Gen Z generation, there's more access to, I think what we need to do is better define what fame is. It's more like, do you have a lot of people watching you? Because getting a lot of people to follow you online and through Instagram and especially through TikTok, is actually quite, sometimes easy. You could either do a viral video. Sometimes, I mean, it's just being attractive. And unfortunately, how much you'll show of your body can get you a lot of views and a lot of likes. I am seeing more and more people do that, where it's like, wow, there's so many social media influencers that have over 50,000, 100,000 followers and likes and all that. But they're very unknown in their actual real world, if you will. Like, they might have 100,000 followers, but do DoorDash as their full-time job. So they might, and I even remember when I first started getting into this about 6-7 years ago, I was like this kid that was like really well known, posting videos all the time. A lot of people across the country online knew who he was. And then when I met him in person, he worked at Chick-fil-A, and I was like, that's not bad. I mean, that's what I actually expect of a 20-year-old or an 18-year-old, but I just wouldn't have thought that based on the way you portray your life to be. And so there are more, again, that are pursuing. I want that because it looks really good, at least online, until you get maybe a little closer and realize it's not as big as it is. I also would assume that it's kind of probably can be difficult to be so like, I'm known, but I'm actually not that known, or I'm known, but I'm actually not that successful. However, I also am seeing young people that are caring less and less about social media. Old soul is a phrase I use a lot for young Gen Z leaders. Just like you guys are like old souls. Like, I feel like I'm around as old people, and those are the ones that are more mature and they don't care. And I almost would liken it to this person is like, for millennials, I don't think they bought into the American dream. Xers and boomers did, especially boomers. The idea that I think that boomers pursued provision, and they were also raised by and a little bit post the Great Depression. So the idea of making money and putting food on the table and making a living, even a great living if possible, was something that they pursued. And I would say that while they pursued provision, the millennial generation especially pursued passion, purpose over provision. And so I almost think of the book, the movie Dead Poets Society as a great example symbolically of what I think a generation did, where it was like the dad, boomer, got him into the school, and the kid wants to go do theater arts, and he's at this incredible like prep school for Ivy League schools. And the dad's like, we have a quote from the movie when he finds out, he's like, he tells his son, Neil, he said, me and your mother have sacrificed way too much and worked way too hard to get you into this school so that you can go and be a doctor, for you to go and throw it away, throw your life away by going into theater arts. But for this kid, he doesn't see it as throwing away. He sees it as pursuing his passion, maybe even his purpose. And so, 52% of young leaders in the millennial generation, or young people, they found through Business Journal, did a survey and found that 52% were willing to take a drastic pay cut in their job if they got to do something that had fulfilled their purpose and their mission in life and in their gifting. And so I think there was a shift away from seeing that experiment of pursuing provision, getting the white picket fence, the house, the car, maybe the boat, and all that. But if you're familiar with Halftime by Bob Buford, it's a big book for marketplace leaders. It's kind of this like half midlife crisis where people got that. And these are for like a lot of successful marketplace leaders. And then they realized, man, is this it? Like, I gave up so much. I actually, I think like you're saying that you hope that Gen Z sees that the bankruptness in social media and platform and being known and being famous. I do think millennials definitely saw that in Xers and boomers from pursuing, and especially for millennials, seeing their fathers pursue jobs that they absolutely hated, didn't even enjoy at all. And you could just tell by when they came home from work, it's like all they wanted to do was veg out. They had no joy at that job. However, they provided an unbelievable life for their family. Yeah. So they kept doing it for many, many years. Like for 20 years, our dad did this job. And for millennials, they can't even fathom doing a job they don't like for 6 months. And so they shifted away from that again. And that I think is actually a good thing, but then they're shadows. Cause I always say millennials might be one of the most passion driven, purpose driven generations that are absolutely broke. They have no money. And so that's why, again, I think discipleship is key in that again, too, is it's not either or, it's both and, but when the enemy gets us to just critique one side, swing the pendulum the other, we're going to miss out some good stuff.
It makes sense that they would see, going back to the famous thing, like that makes sense, because given the fact that oftentimes the people they see as famous are, you know, YouTubers, TikTok, whatever. And oftentimes, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but you said it. I mean, you can get a huge platform and not really have much talent. I mean, we live in a world where Kim Kardashian is now a billionaire, and she even says, like, what do I do? Like, I just, but I think that, so, you know, you have a kid that's like, has their favorite YouTubers, doing funny cat videos with a million followers. Like, well, I can do that. Create a channel in 5 minutes. And, yeah, you know, it's like, well, of course I'm going to get a million followers. Like, they did it. Like, why wouldn't, you know?
Yeah.
I am nervous, Grant. And even this came out, I wouldn't say necessarily with the specific people at the gathering we were at, but just the idea of being able to get such a massive influential platform at such a young age. I would say this of anybody really, but because Gen Z, well, not Gen Z, but because we live in a generation now where you can go from nobody to still a nobody, but with a massive platform, or like, there's no, like,
yeah,
you didn't, in a sense, you didn't gain the life experience and wisdom of getting there. So I've got a, like, my oldest daughter is a musician, and we talk a lot about, you know, like the old days of how did you make it in the band in the 80s? It's like, man, the steps you had to take to work your way up to playing in coffee shops on the streets and bars and this, that, da, 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 and maybe get an album, you know, way later on or whatever. Now it's like, gosh, you can, oh crap. Oh, you there?
Yeah.
Sorry, that's fine. So now, you know, now you can get famous if your YouTube video goes viral, you know, and it's like, you can bypass some of the, and I sound so crotchety by saying, but like the hard work of getting, but not just the hard work, but just the life experience and wisdom. And it's easy. Well, when you've had lots of ups and downs and ups and downs and denials and then success and down, you know, it's easy to cultivate some level of maybe humility of like, man, I got beat up a lot, but I now have this platform, whatever. But to just go from nobody to all of a sudden super famous, I'm nervous about that. With a 19-year-old, all of a sudden has a huge platform, and now they think that, and they're influential, but it's like, that makes me nervous, you know? People are absolutely. Like, hey, what do you think? Okay, what's your view on sexuality? Well, actually, like, well, you don't know. Like, I'm like,
yeah, no, they don't.
And we do, we tend to think that just because somebody has a platform now, we do this with celebrities, right? I mean, what does Robert De Niro think about politics? Like, does he have a degree in poli sci? Like, when did he become an, you know, anyway, is that right for me to be nervous, or do you see that as a concern?
You're spot on. I mean, so, Preston, before 3 years ago, all I did was focus on leaders in Dallas. Cause that was my heart, was Dallas, Texas. And, I used to joke and say, I want to be the, like, my title technically was George Bailey enthusiast. And George Bailey from It's a Wonderful Life is just my favorite movie. And I just love that guy and the concept of that movie. When you really think about it, is, I think if you were a Christian, especially, is like, this is a guy that for his whole life had to live for decades in a city that he couldn't wait to get out of, go move somewhere else. Cause he thought the grass was greener in some other city, and there was greater experience to be at some other city. Yeah, but he never got to leave. And I kind of liken him to young people where they're like, man, I want to go move to LA or New York or Nashville or some other cool city. And I don't think Dallas is not a cool city. I could be in like Oklahoma or something. but I didn't see, I saw a lot of people wanted to leave Dallas and leave that city. And basically, they want to go change the world and be a part of something bigger than himself, like George Bailey. But what I like about that story is he gets to see what the world looks like if he didn't exist. Mm-hmm. And the lack of his presence in that city drastically changed the community. He was, the city was just darker. It was different. It was in such a bad place. And I kind of thought to myself, man, just one person not existing made that kind of impact. And so that's a long way to say, I was so dedicated to, I want to start getting young Christians to commit to the city of Dallas for the next 10, 20, 30, 40 years, or at least unless God says otherwise, we're all in at the city. We're not waiting for him to give us the go to leave or do something else. We're just all in together, united in the city. And so the only thing that made me shift away from just focusing on Dallas leaders was from speaking and traveling and meeting all these other high caliber young Christian leaders from other parts of the country that were getting huge book deals, huge online platforms, speaking, author, whatever it may be, professional athletes. And I started realizing, man, these guys need community and they do need others pouring into them. Because just like you say about Robert De Niro, is You can't assume just because they're a professional athlete and they're successful in that one arena,
right,
that means they're just a leader and mature in all these other arenas. Because at the end of the day, they may have a million followers or a huge book deal or whatever, but they still have, they're still 19 years old and they're still 25 or whatever it may be. And so I started doing retreats for young leaders. My last 7 years I've been doing it, and there was a group that let me sponsor, or not even sponsor, they sponsored 20, 25 young leaders that were high caliber young leaders to go to Israel for free. And they let me pick them. And so like I did like six trips where I got to take all these young people to Israel for free. And I got to know them deeply because of 9-day trips each time. I did like tons of them. And that's where I met a lot of these young guys too, because most people say yes to a free trip to Israel.
Yeah.
And I got to know all these unique high caliber young leaders. And I just was like surprised by some of them are like more mature than you realize, but I would say a lot of them still need development, still need discipleship, as much as I would say I still need discipleship. But I think people would be surprised how much, they're wildly unprepared for one, the culture that lies ahead of us as Christians in the next 10, 15 years, two, the discipleship and biblical development that they need. So 3 years ago, I shifted and said, you know, I'm seeing so much fruit come out of these side projects of this Israel trip and some of these retreats I'm doing that I'm just doing because people are offering these free trips or, hey, you want to do a retreat for these guys? I have a great place. That 3 years ago, I'm like, I'm just going to go all in and try to help what I was doing in Dallas. I'm going to broaden to America, starting to bring us all together. Like, what if we could change our nation and impact our nation united? And one of the things that we got to do was this mentor day with Greg Laurie. Are you familiar with him out of California? Yeah. Does these massive evangelistic crusades, for those listening that may not be, and hundreds of thousands of people come into stadiums over several days. And we did a day where we came to his crusade, but the day before we met with him. And I was actually consulting his church at the time. This was about a couple years ago. And I was consulting his staff under 40, and he was in the room. And he came up to me. He's like, hey, tomorrow we're going to meet with all these young leaders, and all my staff is telling me that you have all these connections, and the guys that are coming are like just unbelievably influential young people. He's like, could you tell me about them? And so I tell him, yeah, this kid is huge on YouTube. Like, I can almost guarantee you if you brought him to speak to your youth, I think more than half of the youth would know who this guy is, if not more. He's just like in the same way that, I mean, basically I said, I don't know if you know, but like Gen Z doesn't really watch TV anymore. They watch YouTube channels and subscribe to them. Like, this is one of the most subscribed to channels. I was like, this girl's 19. And I was like, he's a multimillionaire and he's 19 years old. And he has a huge mansion in Newport Beach. And then I was like, this girl right here is 20 years old, maybe 19. She just signed a huge book deal with Zondervan. And I was like, this guy has millions of followers here. This guy is like musician. And they're all like mostly 25, 26 or under. And he's like, wow. I said, collectively, this group probably has like 20, 25 million followers online, if not more. And it's only a group of like 20 people. And he's like, that's crazy. Like, absolutely insane. And he said, also, I want to mention, it's absolutely like terrifying. And I'm like, why? And he said, here's why. He said, think about this, Grant. He's like, when I was 19, like you're talking about this girl with a huge book deal, this guy with a mansion. When I was 19, I'd be lucky. He said, I'd be lucky if some of the youth pastors let me preach to the youth at that time. And if they started letting me do that, my character, so my opportunities here, he's like, my character's starting to catch up over the next season to where the opportunities are. Because God does tend to give you opportunities bigger than your character could handle, but your character starts to catch up and then you can be trusted with a little bit more. And I'd get some more opportunities and more platform, if you will, and maybe even more some money. And then my character starts to catch up to that. And then I get some opportunity. And he's like, honestly, you're about my age and you feel like your character is finally starting to catch up to the things God's doing through you. But your generation, it sounds like they're making sometimes more money than I am at my age.
Yeah.
They're getting bigger book deals and they are still just 19 years old. And you just can't microwave the kind of character and development and failure and just humility checks that are going to be needed at that time. And so he just said, And this is at the time, James McDonald, who's one of his best friends, had just fallen out of ministry. And so he mentioned, he's like, and James McDonald, he's like, how many guys have we seen fall out of ministry? And that's from the older generation. Yeah. And they still didn't have the kind of accountability it sounds like they needed. Yeah. He's like, with your generation, we might just see one of the worst falling out of generation in Christian leadership that we've ever seen because of the massive amount of platform influence finances that this group is getting at sometimes, without the development of discipleship and character to sustain it. And so I think you're spot on. And that's a lot of why I kind of started shifting away from just let's unite and let's come together to even joining Q. And Gabe was like, I can only pour in so much. I'm barely, sometimes I'm the same age as you guys. And sometimes I'm just a few years ahead. But there's a group that's been around for 18 years that is all about equipping and preparing the next generation of Christians for what lies ahead, plus Axiom and all the great mentors that can come out of that. So we're just getting started, but that was the I think a God thing to bring that relationship at the time he did.
That's good. No, that when I hear millions of followers, 8-19 and book deals and stuff. I mean, we need more. We have access to unlimited knowledge, no doubt, but we need wisdom, and that you can't. I love your phrase. You can't, would you say microwave that?
Yeah.
You can't, you need that life experience to cultivate genuine wisdom. And I remember, Francis Chan told me that he's like, I told myself I will never write a book until I'm 40 years old. And he's like, I'm a 35 year old. What do I have to say to people at 35, you know, with only 15 years of ministry experience? He wrote Crazy Love when he was 40 years old. And even someone like an N.T. Wright. N.T. Wright wrote a couple scholarly books in his 30s and 40s, but he really didn't start writing like at his – well, the one time I talked to him, he waited till his kids were out of the house. But think about this. This is so awesome. He's like, I don't have time to write. Like, I was teaching, doing this, and I wanted to be with my family and kids, and – you know, it was after they're out of the house when he was like in his late 40s, early 50s, when he started to really write. And he spent the last 20 years publishing, you know, 10 books a year or whatever. But just that idea. And that, again, that sounds so, I'm not saying that's gospel truth or that's, you know, that there's no 25-year-old that has wisdom. I'm not saying that. But as a general pattern, I think at least having that caution, at least having that, like, man, I don't need to race. I need to focus on cultivating virtue and character and wisdom and humility and let my platform and leadership flow out of that when God decides to bring it. You know, what if somebody who wants to write a book at 25, what if they waited till they're 40? What if, like, why not? You know, and I didn't do that. I wrote a book at 32, I think. So I'm not saying that that's something everybody should do, but just that knowledge that, man, that slow, that long obedience in the same direction, Eugene Peterson book. In the discipleship process, I want to instill that in the next generation. Do you have any thoughts? And I know we got to wrap this up, but I know there's lots of conversations about just changes in how we do youth group. Do you have any thoughts on that? I mean, there's some people who talk about even like the youth group crisis, that how we did youth group for the last, kind of in the pre-internet age, is just really live in a different world now. And we need to disciple, not just create.
Yeah. I mean, that's going to
avenues where
always be my answer.
Okay. Yeah. Do you have any thoughts if you have youth pastors listening and like, man, I want to disciple my kids. What would be some pieces of advice that you would give them?
Yeah, I mean, this is an answer for the whole church, but it definitely would impact youth ministry. Is I would say, if the church can do one simple thing that would inevitably lead to several new things, is I would just say measure discipleship in your church. Simply doing that, of measuring discipleship in your church, inevitably would lead to so much, because I feel like, it's not that we have the wrong scorecard. I just don't think we have as robust of a scorecard that we need in the church. Our scorecard, according to Jim Cimbala, he kind of says in Fresh Wind, Fresh Fire, that we mostly just count butts, budgets, and buildings. And I have a mentor who said, what you count and what you celebrate it creates your culture. And I really thought about that. I was like, man, it really is true of different churches. I think of even not even churches, but organizations or even parts of culture, little pockets of culture. I'm like, what they count and what they celebrate, you'll get a good idea of what their culture is based on the, what they're counting and measuring success, the kind of person they're celebrating. And I just think in the church, we mostly celebrate speaking. That's the most over-glorified gift in the church, in my opinion. We don't glorify the gift of, we under-glorify the gift of disciple making. We over-glorify the gift of speaking. And I just think what we count in the church specifically is, again, butts, budgets, buildings. And I think that's good. I'm never trying to say, let's stop counting giving and let's stop counting attendance and let's stop counting this, whatever we're going to add to the building and the campaign or whatever it may be. However, I just want us to start counting disciple making, because the sad part is so many churches actually have disciple making, the phrase and the action in their mission statement. It's like, we exist to glorify God through making disciples, blah, 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 in our city, but whatever. And then you ask them, okay, it's in your mission statement. How many disciples did you make this year? And they'll be like, oh, well, yeah, this many people came to church. This many people are giving, this many people are in small groups, which is great. I'm glad we count those things. It's just not discipleship. And so, I think about that. I'm like, man, Chick-fil-A really cares about making chicken sandwiches. And I can guarantee you, they know how many chicken sandwiches they made last year. Like, Nike makes shoes and they know how many shoes they made last year. Tesla makes cars. They know how many cars they made. We make disciples and we have zero idea how many disciples we make each year. And so, again, I don't think we have a next gen problem. I think we have a discipleship problem. But what that means for youth is, if we started making account at measuring discipleship, it would force us to define discipleship.
Yeah.
It would force us to create a plan for discipleship, so we know if we are not on track. And it would start to kind of tell the people, it's not enough to just show up. It's not even enough to give, or it's not enough to even be in a small group. On a one-to-one level, we want to know, do you have a relationship with someone younger than you in the faith? Statistically, Barnes found that only 17% of Christians do. Only 17% of Christians have a relationship where they have committed to pour into someone individually younger than themselves. And I would actually ironically think fixing the discipleship problem would fix a lot of the next gen being in church problem, because although the next generation may not connect to institutions, they do connect to individuals who represent institutions. And there's already been statistics to show that one of the key factors of young people who stay in church post-college, when they have to leave their home and they're no longer living under their family's faith, is when they had someone who was mentoring or discipling them, because they had a connection to the church that was bigger than just, am I going to show up? It's like someone was going to ask. Someone was who they sat with. Someone was there in small group or on mission with them. And so I too often think that churches kind of treat discipleship like a luxury instead of a necessity. But I think if we added it, as it would actually lead to better giving and better attendance and all that kind of stuff.
You know, I wrote a whole book on this. Nobody's read it or even heard about it. It's called Bringing Discipleship to the Front Lines of Faith. It's based on a Barna study on discipleship, the state of discipleship in the church. I think it was 2015. So Navigators commissioned Barna to do the study. Then they commissioned me to write kind of a book that draws out the implications of the study. And then it kind of turned into more of my kind of vision for what discipleship looks like in the church, to kind of categories and stuff. And it's, I would fully agree that we have, that's the whole premise of the book and the study, is we have a growing, I mean, it's been growing, but it continues to grow, discipleship problem in the church. And maybe it's because we do measure, like, and this is a generality, but I mean, maybe it's because we think that if the church is growing numerically, that we're fulfilling our discipleship job. And it's like, maybe, I mean, sermons can contribute to discipleship. Even small groups can contribute and this and that, but like, is it actually happening? And how do you even measure that without being overly weird about, you know, quantifying it? But I mean, yeah, are people being more generous and being more, you know, reaching out to the poor more? Are they serving others? Are they preaching the gospel? Are they, you know, various way? Or even like, I even have a whole chapter on like multi-ethnicity as discipleship, you know, like that's a obviously a massive blind spot in the church. It's like if you're all white church in a diverse neighborhood is growing and doing this and doing that and being gender, all this stuff. But if it's still all white, not multi-ethnic, I think that's a problem. I think that that's a piece of the kingdom of God that you've kind of missed out on. But Grant, I've taken you over your time. I know you've got stuff to do, but man, I thank you so much for what you do. And how old are you? Are you 30? No.
Yeah, I am.
I that's what I thought. 31. So I'm 45. And so you're just in a sweet spot of having that wisdom and maturity, and yet young enough to where you truly do understand. I think you're so deep in the younger generation. So I have leaned on you. I'm going to continue to lean on you for helping me out. Cause man, huge, huge need in the church, right? To pass on this faith mantle to the next generation. So thank you.
And bro, and I would encourage you, and I would be gladly help, is I would say after this, like, get one or two Gen Z leaders on and ask them. I mean, that's the one thing I wish that I used to say that when I was in my 20s, and every time I would speak on the next generation, especially at a church, most of them would be 80% of the people, if not 90, were above 40. So they're there to learn about the next generation. Yeah. Then a small percentage of the group, they would always sit together, were the actual young people.
Interesting.
And I always knew I'd be like that too. If I was young and I heard my pastor say, hey, we're getting this guy to teach us about the next generation so we can better reach them. And I've been in the church for a while, I've been helping, but you guys don't listen to me. Mm-hmm. But now you bring this other guy in to come talk about it. So they'd always sit, they're always kind of judgmental. And I get it. Again, they're like, who is this guy to talk on behalf of an entire generation? But at the end of almost every time, they would say, hey, we totally agree with a lot of what you said. We've been saying almost everything that you've said. You just say it a little better than we do. And they invited you in to speak, or you're more well-known than we are. And I would tell people a lot, is like, you know, I cost a lot more money than these guys that are at your church every week that are saying apparently the same thing that I'm saying. And so I was like, you should always start with asking them. Because I'm in there and they're going to stay, cause I'm going to leave. But they're actually there. And so, the good thing, I always joked, I was like, The irony about the next generation is so often we ask people that are influential among the next generation instead of asking the next generation. The great thing about the next generation is, unlike if we did a study on like whales and we were trying to find out, hey, why are whales migrating away from the church, or why are they migrating over here? They're not eating kale anymore. They're wanting this or whatever. Like, we can't find out why. We can make assumptions, but with Gen Z or millennials, so like, you can just go ask them. They speak English. Like, we can talk to them. And so anyway, all that to say is I think I can bring a unique perspective because of I can see the difference between my generation and their generation. But I'd love to also bring some Gen Z guys on too. And I want to listen to them and see, okay, where am I right and where am I wrong?
Well, let's connect offline and maybe you can throw me some names. I thought that's a great, I mean, I've got four living in my house, but that's a little different. But yeah, I would love to. That's a great, great idea. Absolutely, man.
Awesome.
All right. Well, take care, man. Thanks for being on the show.
See you, President.